Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Well, we're a little less than 4 weeks away from Election Day. And while very little is certain in politics, we can say with certainty that Oklahoma's 1st Congressional District will have a new congressman in 2013, as Republican Jim Bridenstine defeated incumbent Congressman John Sullivan in the GOP primary. Bridenstine will face independent Craig Allen and Democratic nominee John Olson, who is my guest today. Olson is a military veteran, attorney, and small business owner whose military service includes deployments to Afghanistan and South Korea. This is his first candidacy for public office. We're joined by John Olson, Democratic nominee for the 1st Congressional District, and we've extended invitations to the other congressional candidates as well. John Olson is my guest today. John Olson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Usually when we do these interviews, the first thing I ask is, if you're elected, what's the number one priority that made you run in the first place and why you want to go to Washington?
Well, I guess it's two different questions. So let me start out with why I decided to run in the first place, and then I'll go with what's my number one priority. I'm in the Army. I've been in for 15 years. I've been on active duty. I'm in the reserves right now. And during the debt ceiling fight last year, one of the consequences of it, other than us losing our credit rating as a nation, was that training across the entire Army Reserve was canceled. And if you think about a unit that's about to deploy or about to mobilize, say a month or a week away from their mobilization, they've got a lot to get done. And it just put a lot of additional pressure on those units. In addition to that, a lot of people in the reserves didn't get paid because the training was canceled. And even on active duty, pay was delayed. So if you're expecting to get paid on the 1st and the 15th of every month, and your mortgage comes out on the 16th, and there's no money there, then you're in a financial bind, and that affected thousands and thousands of people across the country, and it was because of politics. And I got very frustrated about that, so that's why I decided to run. Now, what's my big priority that I want to get done in Washington? Well, I think the first thing that needs to happen is that we do need to pass a rational, sane budget. That's got to happen, because a lot of the gridlock that's happening is happening because companies across the country can't predict what's going to happen more than 90 days out. And if we don't provide some political stability, some economic stability in this country, then the recession is going to continue to be weak in recovery.
So what components make up a rational, sane budget?
Well,
in your mind? And granted, that's one of out of 535.
Right. Well, I think we understand that there needs to be some spending cuts that have to happen. And I'll give you an example of one. When I was in Afghanistan, one of the things that I saw was we, the U.S., hired a contractor to make uniforms for the Afghan army and send the uniforms to Afghanistan. And they did exactly what we hired them to do. They made the uniforms and sent them to Afghanistan, but the Afghan army didn't have the storage capacity to hold those uniforms. So in some cases, twice a week, they would take everything that we sent them and they would make a big pile and they would light it on fire. I mean, you're really watching your tax dollars go up in smoke. Well, I think it doesn't matter what party you're in. We can all agree that that's waste and we should not do that. And I'm sure there are thousands of examples across the whole spectrum of things that are similar to that that we should not do. At the same time, we have to realize that we have to raise revenues. And I'm not talking about drastically, but I'm talking about at least going back to the tax rates that we had under President Clinton. And again, you know, I'm an Army guy and I look at things from a military perspective. And only about 1% of Americans ever serve in the armed forces. And we've asked that 1% to pay our nation's debts in red. And I will insist that we ask the wealthiest 1% to pay their share in green. It's as simple as that. Now, when I say that, one of the things that I would like to point out is there are a lot of loopholes in our tax code that we need to close. And I'll just give you kind of a simple example. Take an investment banker, for example. They might make a base salary of $100,000 a year. And then they'll get maybe $10 million in what's called management compensation. And that's classified as a capital gain. The problem is they didn't put any of their own capital at risk to make that $10 million. So really, it's salary, just called something else. And we lose a lot of revenue because of this loophole. That is a loophole that I would close. And I think that no matter what political party you're in, we can recognize that that's something that's wrong. And you can do the same thing on the corporate side. I mean, General Electric, for example, hasn't paid any federal taxes in 5 years plus. And my 19-year-old daughter, who's working two jobs and going to Tulsa Community College, is paying more. Well, that's not right. At the same time, when we're making cuts and we're raising revenues the way that we should be, we have to recognize that we still need to invest in certain things. We still need to pay for roads and bridges. We still need to pay for education. We still need to invest in energy. And when you talk about spending, one of the things that I think has been lost is that we don't talk about the difference between operating spending and investment spending. And when you buy a house, for example, you might pay $150,000 for it and pay it off over 30 years. And nobody ever says that you're running a $150,000 deficit. They say that you made an investment. And likewise, in the government, we should invest in our kids. We should invest in our energy infrastructure. We should invest in our roads and bridges and our dams. Those are things that we've got to do. Now, one of the distinctions that I like to draw, because it's important to understand, is I support a balanced approach. All that I just said, I think, is a balanced approach. My opponent's plan, instead, is to repeal all federal taxes, Social Security, Medicare, income, capital gains, all of that, and replace it with a 30% federal sales tax on all goods and services. And so what that means is, if you go to the gas station, instead of spending $50 on a tank of gas now, it's $65. If you go to the grocery store, instead of spending $100, it's $130. If your mortgage is $1,000, it's now $1,300. If you go to the doctor for an immunization shot or chemotherapy, add 30%. If you are the city of Tulsa and you have to pay for police services, fire services, ambulance and emergency services, trash services, you need to add 30% to all of those services and send a check to the federal government.
Well, of course, you know, sales tax is tremendously regressive, and it hurts the lower incomes more than it does the higher incomes, because if you do repeal those taxes, you're looking at even the lowest employed is going to receive about 7 to 8% more in their salary if that's all they're paying is payroll taxes. And of course, withheld taxes, that's another 10% added on to their salary.
Absolutely. You're right. But you add in addition to that, a lot of senior citizens are affected as well, because if you're retired, you've already been paying income taxes your entire working life, and now you're retired. Well, if we change the tax code all of a sudden, now you get taxed again because you have all these sales taxes that you have to pay. So it hits you twice, and that's not the right answer either.
So before we move on to other issues, you know, this is your first political office try, and it's a major one too, a federal office. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You mentioned you served in the Army and the Army Reserve. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I started out going to Tulsa Community College, and then I moved on to Northeastern State. And then after that, I graduated and went to University of Tulsa. And that's where I earned a master's degree and a law degree. From that, I started a human resources consulting company, and what I do is survey work. So if you've ever done a survey about what you like and don't like about your job, that's what I do, and I advise companies on how to make things better for their organization. I'm also an attorney. I kind of do that as a hobby. My wife works for this organization called the Bear Foundation, and she works with therapeutic foster kids. And every now and again, one of them will need a power of attorney or a will or something along those lines, so I'll do those things for free just to keep in practice, I guess. And like I said, I'm married, and my wife and I have 6 kids.
Now, did you serve in the Army after your college service? Or
during.
During. You've been always in the reserves for the most part.
Well, I started out on active duty, and my first duty assignment was in Korea back in 1998. And then I served in the 101st Airborne for a couple of years, and then I switched over to the reserves and was in the reserve, became a drill sergeant, and trained new soldiers in the summertime. In 2008, while I was going to school, I took a break and went to Afghanistan and came back and then finished law school after that and continued on and just, I guess, started everything after that.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the big issues. You talked about the deficit. Now, chances are the big sequestration, which this was sort of your impetus for getting into politics. This is the result of the debt ceiling talks. And, the big committee failed to reach agreement, so there are going to be mandatory cuts in defense and a discretionary spending at the first of the year. Now, the thought now is that the lame duck Congress will take care of this. But if you're elected and you come back in January and all these cuts are taking place, what would be your first action as a congressman?
Well, we would have to pass a budget that would be able to repeal this sequestration, because it really is drastic. It's really draconian. It's really the reason that sequestration was put into place was to force a deal to happen. And what I think is going to happen is not that the lame duck Congress is going to be able to solve the problem. I think what they're going to do is kick the can down the road for the next Congress to deal with, which means that I am going to have a role in doing that. And I think that one of the things that you're going to see out of this election is I think you're going to see a lot of people in the country start voting towards the middle. I think you're going to see a lot of people voting towards common sense solutions, because you've seen what happened with extremism on both sides of the spectrum, and there was nothing that got done. And the reason that the popularity of this Congress is so horrible is because nobody was able to compromise. And I think that you're going to see a move towards more compromise and more common sense solutions in the next Congress and thereon after. So the first thing that's got to happen is that we have to get together. We have to pass a budget that's rational, that's sane, that addresses all the problems that we have, that realizes that we do have to have spending cuts, we do have to raise revenue, we still have to invest where it pays off, and we're going to see something that moves in that direction in order to avoid sequestration.
Now, if you still have Congress and the presidency at loggerheads, mm-hmm. you're looking at still, right now, the Republicans that say no revenue increases, and right now the Democrats are saying we really don't want any cuts in discretionary or entitlement spending. Where are some of the areas you can find common ground?
Well, we'll take Social Security, for example, because a lot of people talk about that as an entitlement. Well, Social Security and Medicare are earned benefits. They're classified as entitlements, but you've paid your entire working life to receive those benefits. And those programs are still solvent. There are reasonable things that we can do to make them last for a long, long time, like lifting the cap on Social Security tax and adjusting the cost of living adjustment so that it doesn't outpace the actual cost of living.
How much would you adjust the COLA by? Like a 0.25%, something like
well,
that?
Well, I don't know that we need to make a specific numerical adjustment. I think you have to adjust the formula
okay.
to make sure that it goes in line with what the actual cost of living is. Because if you just put an arbitrary number out there and the cost of living is less than that, say over the course of 40 years, that adds up to a significant increase in the benefit that you've earned that outpaces our ability to pay for it. So just keeping that in line and lifting the cap is enough to make Social Security and Medicare last into the next century.
Well, it's enough to make Social Security last. Now,
right.
Medicare is a different animal. Well, I mean, the Social Security, as much as people talk about it, you're right. There are very modest steps you can do, which means adding more money that's subject to Social Security mm-hmm. tax on the high end for
right.
high income earners, about a little over 100,000. If you move that up even slowly, you make that program solvent. And I suppose if you adjusted the COLAs, that would make it even easier to make mm-hmm. it more solvent. Medicare, though, this is a hard nut because you're looking at major increases in medical costs each year. Now, certainly it's slowed this last year, but you know, a lot of people look at this and they say it's hard to see where it's going to be sustainable unless you make major changes in the program.
Medicare is a different animal entirely because it's related to healthcare. And so we have to recognize that healthcare in this country has to be addressed as a whole before we can do something about Medicare. And one of the things about this campaign that's come up is the Affordable Care Act. And it's something that I support. Now, I don't for a second pretend that it's the perfect answer to everything, and there's going to be a lot more work that needs to be done to improve it. But as you see the costs of healthcare start to draw down, let's start where we were. The average cost of healthcare in this country was about $7,800 per person per year before the Affordable Care Act was put into law. And it had double-digit increases every year. And that means that if we didn't pass the Affordable Care Act, the next year it would be about $8,500 per person per year. And the year after that, you're getting close to $10,000. It doesn't take long before you're starting to price a big chunk of Americans out of the ability to afford insurance and afford health care, which means that they resort to the most expensive form of health care, which is the emergency room. And that puts the entire cost of health care in this country on hospitals. Well, with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, a couple of things have happened. One, you can keep your kids on your insurance until they're 26. So they're getting health care. They're getting preventative care. Two, people like a woman with breast cancer, a six-year-old with leukemia cannot be denied care. Nobody can be denied care because they have a pre-existing condition. That's a good thing. And that makes sure that they don't get to the horrible point where they can't do anything. They can actually treat things. And that's going to bring down costs overall. Lifting lifetime caps so that people can go in and know that they can get care. These are steps in the right direction. And you've already seen the increase in insurance, instead of being double digit, dropped down to 4%. Now, that's a step in the right direction, and you're going to see healthcare costs in this country continue to decline. One of the offshoots of that, of preventative care, is I think you're going to see part of the obesity problem in this country go down as people become more educated, as they have more access to knowledge, and as they have better access to information about how they need to treat their bodies, they're going to be healthier. And I think you're going to see a reduction in the obesity rates in this country, and we continue to need to have to work towards those types of efforts as well. All of this together is going to help reduce healthcare costs, and that is going to help bring down the cost of what Medicare is going to cost us overall. All of this has to be looked at as a whole rather than one isolated thing after another, because that's not how we get to the solution.
My guest today is John Olson, a Democratic nominee for the 1st Congressional District in Oklahoma. As we talk to him, we have offered an invitation to his opponent, Mr. Bridenstine, but their camp has declined that invitation at this point. Hopefully we'll have him before Election Day. And John Olson is our guest today. Well, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act is something you do support. Mm-hmm. So if in the next Congress there comes an effort to repeal it, I assume you would vote against it?
I would oppose any efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. I think what we need to do is continue to work to improve it and make it better. And most Republicans, I think, in Congress, even Speaker Boehner, recognize that there are some good things in the Affordable Care Act. And even in their discussion about repeal, aren't suggesting a repeal of the whole thing. My opponent, on the other hand, is, because I've asked him specifically about the parts that I just mentioned, and he said he'd repeal the whole thing.
Hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other issues. Mm-hmm. If the deficit and our level of spending is a big issue,
mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who say, you know, I mean, really the entitlements is where, and Social Security, Medicare, these are areas where that's where the biggest amount of money goes to, and defense.
Mm-hmm.
Let me talk about defense for a moment.
Sure.
You mentioned that you were opposed to the sequestration cuts, but do you think the defense budget is going to need to go down at all?
I do. I think that we can do that without compromising national security, and I think Secretary Panetta has done a fine job as far as identifying areas that we do need to scale things back.
What were the areas you would like to see scale
well,
back?
Well, the reduction in troop numbers, for example. I mean, we increased the number of troops to fight two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've already pulled out of Iraq, and we're drawing down our effort in Afghanistan, and we're starting to transition from a Department of Defense operation into a Department of State operation, and that's the right move. It's the right way to go. Well, as you do that, you have a whole bunch of soldiers that are coming back that we don't have to have go fight wars. So we need to draw down the size of the troops back to levels that are appropriate for the political climate that we're in, the world climate that we're in. And I think that's a step in the right direction. I think that Secretary Panetta has identified that, and we're already seeing the drawdown, and I'm seeing it in as far as not recruiting as many people as we were before and letting people retire and that just not replacing them as they do. That's a step in the right direction, and that's going to save us a lot of money overall. I think that overall, from a national perspective, we need to look at our foreign policy a little bit differently. Because in the past, when we got into two wars, we got into this habit of using our military as a club, using that as our first step in foreign policy. And I think rather than doing that, what we need to do is let the Department of State handle its business and use diplomacy first. One, it's a lot cheaper. Two, it's a lot easier to make friends. And three, it's a lot easier to influence other countries that we want to do the right thing. There are a lot of countries in the Middle East right now, for example, that are forming new democracies, and that's a messy business. It takes a long time to get it right. If we don't let the Department of State be involved and influence these countries to move in the right direction, then we're, in essence, abdicating our ability to make friends, which means that some of these countries might turn out to be enemies, which means that someday, if the wrong administration is in place, we could end up going to war with them, and I'd rather avoid that now if we can.
Let's talk about the fact that democracy is a messy business. We could see some of these countries. We look at Egypt, for example. You know, there is a strong anti-American element at play in the government now. Now, the leader is sort of finding a middle ground. But if we find Egypt has a decidedly anti-American government, what should be the American response?
Well, there are a couple of different levels to that question. One, if we have attacks on U.S. embassies anywhere, we need to track down the people that commit those murders and bring them to justice, first and foremost. Absolutely, there's no compromise there. We need to, from a position of strength, allow those governments to do the right thing and help us track down the people that commit these acts and bring them to justice. Other than that, we the United States, are in a position where we have the strength to be patient. We have more military power. We have more economic power. We have the ability to be patient with these countries a little bit and allow them to move in the right direction. If we leave them and don't participate and don't have a seat at the table, then we don't have influence to be able to help them make the right decisions. We don't have the ability to tell them what we would want them to do. And I think that's the wrong course of action. So we need to stay engaged. We need to make sure that we influence them to do the right thing and move towards a closer friendship.
And so even if they're somewhat antagonistic to us, stay engaged.
Stay engaged.
Yeah, but don't try to undermine the democracy. I mean, this has been the typical American approach over decades. When we see a government we don't like, we try to get rid of it in some way or another, either covertly or overtly in some cases.
Well, the idea in this case is that we just don't cut and run.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not do that.
My guest today is John Olson, Democratic nominee for the 1st Congressional District. He hopes to represent voters in northeastern Oklahoma in the next Congress. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We talked a little bit about taxation levels. You said you felt like, you know, we need to go back to Clinton-era taxation levels. At our current spending levels, that still doesn't cut the gap on the deficit. Are you a believer that we need to have a zero deficit or maybe even running a surplus, or a small deficit is something that is manageable at this point? What is your thought on the whole deficit level?
Well, let's start out with this. Our debt and our deficit have been and continue to be caused by two wars that we didn't pay for and tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans in this country. I like the idea of not having deficit. I like the idea of moving towards a surplus. And we need to get there, and we can get there. I recognize that we do need to cut spending levels in some areas. That's got to happen. We still need to raise revenues to appropriate levels. And I think that the Clinton levels are not too burdensome. I think that everybody recognizes that those are probably what we would consider fair.
Now, earlier, if I may interrupt, excuse me, you were mentioning closing loopholes as far as, you know, investment bankers who take a lot of their salary as capital gains.
Right.
Would you be in favor of raising capital gains rate or keeping them where they are? Because that is a big difference. I mean, this is why Mitt Romney pays 12, 13, 14% of his salary in taxes, because capital gains are lower than average income.
Right. And I think that that's absolutely appropriate to take a look at that. I can't tell you what the absolute level of capital gains should be, but I'm sure it should be higher than 13%. And I don't think that that's really going to stifle investment in this country. Because if something is going to make you a profit, whether it makes you 50 cents on the dollar or 75 cents on the dollar or 83 cents on the dollar, if it's going to make you a profit, you're still going to invest in it. The engine to our economy has been and always will be the middle class and small businesses. And if we don't do things that are going to encourage those areas to grow, then our economy is going to stifle. We could go back into a recession.
Median income, the last figure I saw, is down $2,000. And that, to me, that is the best indicator of where the middle class is. That's Mr. 50%. That's the guy right in the middle. And his household income has gone down to about $2,000 over the last couple of years.
Right.
What are some of your ideas for stimulating the middle class and getting the middle class moving again?
Well, let's start with energy. I think that leading us to a stronger recovery starts with a sound energy policy. And I don't think we have a rational energy policy in the country, because we need to recognize the realities of climate change, but we also need to recognize the resources that we have available. And we need to transition to renewable energy, but we're not there yet. Natural gas is a transition fuel to get us there. And Oklahoma is blessed to have a whole bunch of it. That's why I support the T. Boone Pickens plan. Because what that does is it uses natural gas as a transition fuel to renewable energy. It incorporates wind energy. It incorporates solar energy. It incorporates all these things that we should be investing in. The Natural Gas Act, which is something that Congressman Sullivan was a big advocate for, is a good idea, and I support it as well. The thing about that is that not only does it help build the natural gas infrastructure in this country, 96% of the parts that would be manufactured to build that infrastructure would be manufactured right here in northeast Oklahoma. It's 96%. That's Oklahoma jobs. It's Oklahoma manufacturing. It is Oklahoma energy. That's a win-win-win for Oklahoma. And, you know, my opponent calls that picking winners and losers. I've heard this argument before. Well, there are a couple things. One, geology has already done that. It's already picked the winners and losers. And if we're going to pick winners and losers, I want the winners to be Oklahomans.
Now, how do you convince congressmen, maybe even in your own party in the Northeast, that this is the right approach?
I think that they're starting to see it. I mean, we have to recognize that we have to move towards renewable energy. That is absolutely got to happen. I think that one of the advantages that I would have as a Democrat, where Representative Sullivan or Congressman Sullivan had some difficulty as a Republican, is that I would be able to encourage other Democrats to vote for it and get a bipartisan effort going. And I think that that has some broad appeal across the entire spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've seen price spikes in natural gas, sometimes huge price spikes. I would think if I were a congressman in the Northeast, I would be leery of that. How do you convince them that this is the right approach, though?
Well, I think as far as in Oklahoma, I think everybody recognizes that it's a good thing. Getting the rest of the country on board, I think that there are a lot of there's been a lot of effort on the part of both Republicans and some Democrats to try to push for that. And I would continue to push for it. And I think that people recognize that we have to do something, and that if we're going to become energy independent as a strategic imperative, as an economic imperative, that we have to do something. And this is a move in the right direction. And I think that you're starting to see people move in that direction. I don't think it's as heavy a lift as a lot of people might say.
All right. My guest today, John Olson, Democratic nominee for the 1st Congressional District, and we're just about out of time, so I'll give you an opportunity to make a pitch to the voters. Why should folks vote for you in November?
Thank you for that. Again, my name is John Olson. I am running for Congress in Oklahoma's 1st District, and the difference in candidates in this election is pretty stark. If you want common sense solutions, if you want somebody who's going to use a balanced approach to address our debt and deficit, if you want somebody who understands national security, if you want somebody who is going to work and fight for Social Security and for health care in this country, then vote for me. If, on the other hand, you want somebody who is going to go and yell at the White House, or somebody who is going to fight against health care, or if you want somebody who's going to fight for a 30% federal sales tax on everything that you buy, then vote for the other guy. But I'm the common sense candidate. And I'm asking for your vote, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent.
John Olson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Democratic nominee for Oklahoma's 1st Congressional District, John Olson, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. You can learn more about his campaign at olsonforoklahoma.com. We'll also be hearing from independent Craig Allen later this month. We've also extended an invitation to Jim Bridenstine, the Republican nominee, who has respectfully declined as of this date. Election Day is November 6th. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa and look over our list of recent shows. You can listen online. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.